Being evil queen has never been so fun.
And I am willing to do anything. We will soon be at war.
You will have to take a side.
War with the Protestants.
What fun.
Or war with the Catholics.
None of us are safe.
Feels good to be bad.
The Serpent Queen on Channel 4. Stream now.
Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding. Tonight, we are joined by the great songwriter Amy Allen. Amy grew up in Maine. I grew up in Maine, so that means a lot to me. She grew up playing folk and bluegrass in local venues from a young age, and after 2 years of nursing school at Boston College, she transferred to Berklee College of Music, graduating with a focus in songwriting. She went on to front her band Amy and the Engine, but eventually disbanded the group in order to focus on honing her songwriting craft. After a year working in New York City, she landed her first major cut, a pitch song for Selena Gomez called Back to You. She then moved to Los Angeles, writing almost daily, often doing double sessions, and her tireless work ethic has resulted in a run of hits that have helped define modern pop. We're talking Halsey's Without Me, Harry Styles' Adore You and Matilda, Tate McRae's Greedy, Rosé and Bruno Mars' Apata, and Sabrina Carpenter's Please, Please, Please. In 2025, she became the first woman to win the Grammy Award for Songwriter of the Year Non-Classical. Tonight, live in front of NYU Steinhardt's songwriting students, we'll trace Amy's evolution as a songwriter through five of her most impactful songs, unpacking the craft, collaboration, and creative risks behind each one. Please join me in welcoming Amy Allen. Wow.
I was behind the door the whole time. I have no fucking idea what you just said.
I said a lot of really nice things about all the great things that you've done.
Keep going.
And that's what we're going to do this evening. I want to start with Halsey's Without Me from 2018. Okay. We're going to take a listen, and then we're going to talk about it.
Okay. Tell me how you feel sitting up there, feeling so high, but too far away to hold me. You know I'm the one who put you up there. Name in the sky, does it ever?
How does it feel to go back to 2018?
So crazy.
Will you tell me about the first thing that you remember writing on Without Me?
Yeah. I was with my friend DeLacy, and who's a phenomenal songwriter, and my friend Lewis Bell, who's, I think, one of the best pop producers like of all time. He's phenomenal. He's done a ton of Post Malone. He's fucking great. And it was just the three of us in the room that day, and we were just kind of like talking about heartbreak, and I think we were all similarly going through something, you know, very like, it resonated a lot with us, this idea. And I had sent something to DeLacy the night before, this like little like tiny snippet of poetry that I had thought of, and DeLacy immediately resonated with it, and her and I just like fully caught on. We had never met, and it was like a beginning of a sisterhood, because we couldn't have like complimented each other any better that day in the room, and Lou's so phenomenal. So it was just like one of those songwriter dream days where it just happened really quickly. And I had never had like, I don't know, that song changed the trajectory of my career in a big way. I had had one song before it called Back to You with Selena Gomez, which was when I was still living in New York. And that changed, like that allowed me to sign a publishing deal and like find my manager who I'm with now, who's here today. But this was the song that kind of like solidified my songwriting career, I feel like, because it's kind of like sometimes your first one feels like a little bit lucky. You're like, I don't know if I'm like good at this yet. But maybe that just happened and that was a lucky thing. And so this song was like the moment I had confidence, I feel like, in songwriting, where I was like, okay, I like have done this a second time where I love this song. And then it had a whole life of its own, which was great.
Do you remember what that line of poetry was?
It was something about putting men on a pedestal that they forget how high they are and they don't notice till they look down. Something like that. It was like, you know, classic woman rage. My favorite thing.
I mean, it makes it into the song.
Yeah, it does.
So is that the pre-chorus, perhaps?
It's the kind of the whole chorus of like, how does it feel like sitting up there? I'm about to say the old lyric just then, which I'm not going to do. Which is like, just like being up so high and like too, you know, whatever. You losing track of like who actually helped you get the fuck all the way up there. Like, how does it feel to live without me? You must be really fucking lonely, type of thing.
Let's hear it again.
Oh, no. And then I got you off your knees.
you right back on your feet, just so you can take advantage of me. Tell me how's it feel, sitting up there, feeling so high, but too far away to hold me.
This is a gutting line. I get you off your knees, put you back on your feet, just so you could take advantage of me. It's so dark. And then we move into the chorus.
So dark.
It's really dark.
It's my mom. Every time she listens to a song I write, she's like, are you okay?
Sorry, Mom. We don't write songs usually for our moms. It's unfortunate. We should write more of them.
Yeah,
I appreciate them. But then we go into this chorus and like everything falls out. Uh-huh. Tell me about this moment where everything, this is, you know, in some ways, the antithesis of what we teach about a chorus that needs to be the biggest moment in the song where everything ascends and everything is way up high, except only this person of previous affection is up high and the rest of the song kind of drops out.
Yeah. This chorus is interesting because I listened back to it and it was like a moment where I clicked with like, there's certain notes that emote a lot more than other notes. Mm. And so this chorus, I remember like, I don't usually write from a place of like, thinking ahead of what's happening at the time, but I vividly remember in this moment being like DeLacy and I talking about like that note, that da-na-na-na-na, like that's such like a tension note, and it's like any singer that sings that, it like feels like very emotive, that note just like hanging on it, like really pushing on it. And I remember feeling like every time we tried to change it or like make it a little bit more dynamic at the beginning of the chorus, it felt less emotional, and like actually just like hammering on that one note made it feel so much more like painful. And so I really remember that moment. And then I remember one of us saying after we'd written the chorus, like, I think the chorus feels too long. It feels really long.
Because
then it
chorus.
Goes into that thing, and without me, that it goes for a long time.
Yeah.
It's like, to me, my pop brain was like registering like too long, cut it down. And then we decided not to. We went through a bunch of iterations of it. And I think now, I think that's actually what made that song hooky to a lot of people and catchy, is that like it just keeps evolving. Mm. And now I hear songs like Driver's License or something, and I'm like, that chorus just like keeps fucking going. And I know. And I end up loving songs like that. And I didn't realize we were necessarily doing that in the moment. Or I was trying to fight against it, feeling like it was too long. But I think now, when now listening back, I'm like, sometimes choruses that do that, they just like, a lot of Ed Sheeran songs do that too, where they like, you're like, oh, I thought that was the chorus, but like it's still going. There's like this other section now. It's like really exciting to the listener. So I hear that when I listen to that song.
I wonder if some of it is that in this period, late 2010s, into the early 2020s, I feel like there is a major trend.
Of, what year is that? Is that 2018?
2018 released. Okay. There's a big trend. A lot has happened since then. But there was this trend of writing to loops that the chords, the harmony would generally stay the same throughout much of the song. Mm-hmm. How do you go about writing towards something where the harmony is going to stay the same? You have to build this whole long chorus narrative. Do you think about writing to a static progression differently?
I'm notoriously bad at like if somebody brings in a track that they've like made pre-exist. I don't like writing to loops, straight up. I don't. I usually shut it down. If a producer brings it, there's nothing wrong with it. I know a lot of writers that are phenomenal at it. It's just not, I feel really boxed in when that happens. This song in particular is just, I don't know. I didn't get sidetracked by it. I think because I was like so... I saw the through line of the emotion so like distinctly, and I understood it, that I just was like, it was easy for us to follow it that day. But I think if Lou had brought in that track, that song would have never been written.
What did it come in as?
Nothing. Fully from scratch. Yeah. Like I think he played dun 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 dun, and then we just wrote the entire thing over that. And yeah, like I said, it was just one of those easy days, which is like a dream.
But. Are there things that you think about in terms of building out clear sectional identities between these sections if they're going to have... Because even if it isn't a single like loop from a sample library, when we do have the same chords playing throughout a song, are there certain approaches you have to take?
Like, I remember this being like, okay, well, if the top note of the chorus, we wrote the chorus first, is like... Da-na-na-na-na-na. Like, you don't want to walk all over that note in the pre-chorus or the verse. So I remember making like... you know, being intentional to like make sure the chorus or the pre is like dancing close to it, but like not ever getting to that moment so that when it does hit, it feels like a release. But no, there's few songs in my career that I listen back to and I'm like, I remember vividly like each part, just like we didn't have versions of the verse or versions of the pre or versions of the chorus. It was pretty much like the first verse we wrote was like the verse, the pre was the pre, and then the chorus we tried to shorten, like I said, or change some notes, but it was just one of those fucking good days. I'm not going to lie. I wish there was more I could say about it.
And a transformative day for you. I mean,
very transformative. You're
the first transformative song is with Selena Gomez, and it's a pitch song. This is also a pitch song. This is a sort of more of a rarity today for artists to be taking songs.
Yeah, pitch was way more common back in the day when I started. I'm not going to lie. Like, I don't think I got really my first song getting a song that came out with the artist in the room that was like a transformative song for me was with Harry. Which I'm sure we'll get to one of those songs. But I did so much pitch. Mm-hmm. So much. To the point where I was like, I actually don't want to be in the room with an artist. Because I've gotten so used to doing it without the artist in the room that I was like, I don't want to bring in this new variable that I have to fucking figure out and move with. But my phenomenal manager, Gabs, who's here today, was like, obviously that is a tool that you need in your, toolkit. So then I started doing it, but got really used to doing pitch songs. And now there's a lot less of that because of so many reasons, which we can talk about at some point, I'm sure, too.
How did it get to the next stage? How did this thing actually get made?
What, without me?
Yeah.
Honestly, if I played you the demo, you'd be like, that's exactly what the song sounds like right now. Like, Lou is so prolific as a producer, and the day of bounce that I have, besides the fact that I'm singing it, not Halsey, is like, the production is like exactly the same. And then Halsey wrote the bridge, which is a Cry Me a River interpolation.
I want to listen to that.
Every songwriter's dream.
You don't have to say just what you did. I already know. I had to go and find out from them.
I have to be honest. When I saw that this was an interpolation.
Is that how long the bridge is?
Well, no, it keeps going. But that is the interpolation. Just that moment.
Yeah.
And
that added
And it added a lot of people all into the credits. Justin, Scott Storch, Timbaland, they're all songwriters on this song.
By the way, though, I'm actually grateful for that because that was like a very good lesson for me where it was like, that shit just happens. That just happens. Yeah. It does. And at first I was kind of like, where did this come from? Then I was like, oh no, like that made the song better. It doesn't matter. Like, grateful for whatever it needed to happen to get it across the line. And Halsey's a phenomenal artist. And like, she knew what she wanted. And I'm, as a songwriter, I'm always grateful when the songwriter or when the artist knows what they want to do.
Oh, it's a miracle that any song gets made. So if part of it is having to give some credit to Justin Timberlake, who you later go and also work
now
with.
Now is like my big brother and I love him. Yeah. It's amazing.
Let's listen to Cry Me a River for a second.
Phenomenal song.
Because honestly, when I heard it, I was like, there's an interpolation here? Back to the bridge.
Yeah.
Take me to the bridge. Isn't that what Timbaland says?
Yeah, pretty much. Almost. You don't have to say just what you It's not like super obvious.
No, it's a different melody.
Da-na-na-na-na. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is, I guess, an interpolation, yeah.
This song started as a pitch. Pitch songs have become increasingly rare. Artists are more frequently in the room. You're in the room with them. Mm-hmm. I want to get to know better how you work in the studio. And I'm not the only one who wants to know.
Amy, I am so thrilled for your success. I, like the rest of the world, find myself jamming out to your songs. I mean, I just love them all. They're all so just well done and interesting and unique, all the things that we used to speak about back in class. And I guess if I had a question for you, I would say, how do you approach each session, whether it's with a songwriter, another songwriter, or a producer, or maybe with an artist, are you bringing in a lyric? Are you coming with a melodic idea? Are you sitting in the room just kind of talking and the song comes out of that? How do you prepare? I would really love to know a little bit about your process if I was a songwriter coming up right now.
So yeah, just to be clear, you're a former teacher. So those dreams where you forgot to take the exam, that is happening to you right now. Like, you didn't study.
I got my ass kicked in that class. Bad. She's an amazing teacher. Yeah. I was not prepared for that class when I took it. I went to Berkeley and I didn't know any music theory going in, which is horrible. And I was failing everything. And then I was like, I think I'll apply for this class. And I somehow got in. And I, oh my God. There was like eight of us in every, she would put us in pairs of like 6 to 8 to write a song. Which was like, now I'm like, that's kind of the best boot camp of all time. Because that's like worst case scenario. 8 people having to agree. which is smart by her to be like, this is as bad as it's going to get. And I made so many good friends that I still write songs with all the time now. But okay, to answer her question, the process.
How do you prepare going into a session?
I've kind of tried it always, you know? I think when I was doing a lot more pitch, I was much more in the mindset to like have a long running list on my phone of lines, rarely words. I'm not a good word writer. I'm not like a, I don't like when somebody comes in with like corkscrew and then like figuring out how to write corkscrew. I don't like that. But oftentimes I'll have like a one liner where I'm like, I understand the emotion of that one line. Mm-hmm. Like that's my through line and I can like follow that. I understand it. Sometimes I'll come in with like what sounds like a whole chorus lyric and then at least find a way to repurpose that. But now that I go in mostly with artists, like I rarely do a pitch day. I don't go in with anything. I find that it's been better for me to just be there with like complete clear head. I sometimes will have ideas if like it's really like, you know, dry. We're like neither of us, like there's not a lot of ideas coming from the artist, so they don't have a lot that they're going through right now to talk about. But I usually just go in just being like, play me songs that you love right now. Play me a song if you were to go do karaoke. Like, what song would you sing? I found that has been a really helpful thing, especially with an artist I've never worked with. I'm like, if you were to like cover a song, what are you going to cover? Because then that tells me like melodies that they feel comfortable. I know their range like immediately. Mm-hmm. I also know like the genre and the vibe that they like to do. And I like, it's like kind of usually like your guilty pleasure that like your soul is like screaming is usually that song. So that has become one of my like go-tos. I'm giving all my secrets away. But I just like to be a listener, honestly. I try to like, I have like a reputation of being pretty like militant in sessions because I just like to keep the song fucking rolling. I don't like to dwell. But I try really hard to give like at least 45 minutes to an hour of like just listening and like shooting the shit. I've found that that has helped me a lot. And it's rare that within an hour of talking, like at least the subject of the song doesn't just like come out. Maybe not like the line, but like usually the overarching, like, okay, this is what the person is going through, usually like falls out within that time. Hmm. I have found.
So moving from pitch to all this preparation that you would do in this period of your life where your first year in LA, you've previously said that there was one point where you did 90 days of sessions in a row, like no break.
My manager might fact check me on that, but it was something crazy.
You were doing doubles.
It was something really, yeah, too much.
How many songs were you writing that year?
I'm really bad at math. That's why I got into songwriting. But I don't know, like, so too many. Like,
yeah.
I was doing a 7 days a week for many months on end. And I would be doing, because I didn't have, like, a ton of friends yet. I, like, didn't, you know, I wasn't making, you know, I signed my first publishing deal, which was not, like, a life-changing fucking amount of money, you know. It was, like, I really needed to prove myself. And I was just, like, I'm here. I'm far away from home. What the hell else am I going to do? I might as well just be in the studio and like rolling the dice every day. So that's what I did. And I'm grateful that I did that just because at least in LA, I'm sure you guys, I don't want to like woman-splain, but like there's so many people to be working with in LA that.
And in New York too.
And in New York, of course. I can't speak as much to New York because I was only here for so briefly, but like there's so many writers and producers to work with there that I'm really grateful that I did like whatever it was 90 days in a row without fucking taking a break because it allowed me to find my people and it allowed me to at least my people for that time. Mm-hmm. And then allowing me to find those people allowed me to like get a lot better at songwriting because then I at least had people I was comfortable going in with and just like shedding the fucking songs and going like we just wrote a lot.
Yeah.
Whereas if I had been doing like 4 sessions a week for a year and a half, it would have taken me so much longer to like get my squad together that I loved that I knew I could execute with. So I'm glad I did it, but like, you know, burnout is a thing. I had to take a few weeks off and recoup, but
it's called vacation. That's pretty normal. Yeah. So you go from having this pitch song transforms your life. You then get to get into the room with the artists more frequently. And So let's fast forward a few years. You work with Harry Styles on a huge song called Adore You. But my particular favorite of your collaboration is the song Matilda off of Harry's House.
I love that song.
You can let it go. You can throw a party full of everyone you know. Not invite your family cause they never showed you love. You don't have to be sorry for leaving and growing up. Mm-hmm.
So this sound is a real departure from where we just were.
Mm-hmm.
Can you take me into the room that day?
So the first song we did together was Adore You, which is like my mom's dream because she's like, finally, you did a happy song. Like, thank fucking God, which was really fun. And my dream always with Harry was to like write a really, even Adore You's like, I love that song. That song changed my life again. But this song was the song I always wanted to write with Harry because it's so emotional. I think he's one of the best songwriters I've ever been in the room with. He's just so, he's like a songwriter's dream as an artist because he know his taste is so specific. And he's, everything he says, I'm like, oh, that's, like, you know, he knows so much who he is. And he speaks, in my opinion, he like speaks in lyrics. And that day he came in with like a very specific, like, I want to do this. I think we had maybe written one or two things that day already. And the Adore You day, I think we wrote like four songs that day. Like he's the first artist I had chemistry with, like in a real way, where I was like, oh, working with an artist can make music like 10x what it's ever been for me. Like working with somebody that you actually bounce off with and like they can execute like singing the song, like blowing your mind. It makes the song so much better. But that day, yeah, I think we had written something else. And then it was me, Harry, Tom, and Tyler, who do all of production with Harry, and they're two really good friends of mine and phenomenal. We got to that point in the day and he just was like talking about a story that he wanted to write about, and then I think Tom maybe played that guitar riff, I don't remember, but it, yeah, same thing. So many of my songs that have done well have the same, like, it was just like one of those dream days where I really resonated with the story he was telling, with just like growing up in Maine. And you know, everybody has like a family thing where they're like, you know, that I need to get a, like, move past that a little bit or let go of it or whatever it is. And yeah, it was just one of those days again, I'm not gonna lie.
The first, so we heard Without Me, heartbreak song.
Yeah.
Adore You, fun romance song.
Yes.
This is a really different kind of song. This is like a character song.
Totally a character song.
We're not first person.
Yeah.
We're singing to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Invoking a famous story, the Roald Dahl book, Matilda.
Yep.
Which is about a girl who grows up in a very troubled family.
Mm-hmm.
In order to claim power in her life, she's able to use special powers, telekinesis.
Such a good movie. Ugh. Oh, I love that movie so much. But he, yeah, I don't know. It's just one of those days where like the artist, I'd never had a moment where the artist was like, this is exactly who I am. This is the story I want to tell. And like, let's figure out how to tell this together. I had never been like given that direct of like a brief of what the song is,
yeah.
Like such a narrative.
Harry has talked about the song, about how he said that the person who is listening to the song knows who it's about, but he's not saying who it's about.
Mm.
And so, and part of what we do when we need to write something intimate like that is put another person there, mm-hmm. invent a character.
Mm-hmm.
How is it writing from the perspective of, there's a little bit of removal, there's a little bit of safety perhaps to rewriting Matilda's story?
Mm.
It's not Harry's story, it's not the person that he's talking to, it's Matilda.
Right.
What does that do? How does that change the writing room?
I think for me, at least, like, leaning on him of what feels honest to him without, like, there's certain artists where, like, I can really, like, pry with about, like, what the story is. Or artists that I know well enough where, like, when Sabrina and I are writing, like, I know exactly what we're talking about, who we're talking about, what the thing is. With this story in particular, that's not really something I would, like, pry to be like, well, who is it? You know, it's just like, okay, yeah. There's, like, a story here that we're telling. And leaning on him, if, like, there's a lyric that I say that maybe doesn't fit exactly the thing, then, like, we just, you know, tweak it, whatever, refine it. But I think this was a really good moment in my career where I was like, the biggest trap is to try to write what you think the artist wants you to write, or what, like, radio wants you to write, or, like, what anybody wants you to write. It's so much more about, like, instead of getting into their head, being like, okay, I'm hearing the story you're telling me. What is the story in my life that is the most like congruent with what you're saying, that I can like write in like a parallel line with you, instead of trying to like get into your brain and write what I think you're thinking. And then it usually, I have a lot less like points where I'm missing the mark, because I'm writing from something that is, I feel like I'm resonating and I'm like speaking from my own story. And then it's a lot easier to write. Do you know, I guess, I don't know if that's clear.
It makes sense. I mean, everybody has a Thanksgiving experience of a family member who maybe they wish they didn't have to invite to the party.
Totally.
And it's a gutting lyric, you know, you can throw a party full of everyone you know and not invite your family because they never showed you love. It's another one of those just like, punches you in the gut.
Yeah.
I want to listen to the second chorus, which does something unusual. There's a double chorus with some new material.
You can let it go. You can throw a party full of everyone you know. Not invite your family because they never showed you love. You don't have to be sorry for leaving and growing up. You can see the world following the seasons anywhere you go. You don't need a reason because they never showed you love. You don't have to be sorry for doing it on your own.
So tell me about this. Why do we need a second chorus? What is it doing for the song?
I think there's songs like that, and I feel like as songwriters, you usually know what the type of songs are where it like lends itself to like further explaining the lyric. If it, I don't like doing that unless I feel like there's like really a reason to do that. I feel another learning thing I've realized is sometimes it feels like you're writing lyric for the sake of writing lyric, and it's you're not supposed to. Like sometimes I'm like, oh, but the pre-chorus is supposed to go here, so now we need to find new lyrics for like the pre-chorus, when actually I'm like, maybe we should just cut the second pre and just like go straight to the chorus, because like we don't need to keep fucking talking about what we're talking about. But for the certain songs, there's like, oh, there's so much story here. And if you're resonating with this, you're like really resonating with it. And like it could be a little bit like elaborated on. And this is one of those moments where like there was just, I don't know, it just felt like there was more to say. And then the bridge goes somewhere amazing too, where I love the bridge of that song.
Yeah, it's an amazing brightness. Let's listen for a second.
You're just in time, make your tea and your toast. Framed all your posters and dyed your clothes. Ooh, you don't have to go. You don't have to go home. Oh, there's a long way to go. I don't believe that time.
So
it's long.
It keeps going. I mean, yeah. And it goes into the outro when the chords keep evolving. So the guitar drops out. The bright piano jumps in. Harry is in this very quiet falsetto. It's very vulnerable. Like, it's about to break.
Yeah.
And then the chords sort of leave this. They've been sort of shuffling. It just sort of between the one and the four and the one and the four. And we go into some new territory. So tell me about this transformation that's happening throughout the rest of the song.
I think that when I listen back to that now, I think that was because I knew that wasn't going to be like a single, that song, which oddly in saying that, I get hit up more about that song than I do about a lot of songs that I've had that were like huge radio successes, because people write to me all the time being like, I resonate so hard with that song. Like that is like has gotten me through so much shit, which means so much to me. But when I listen back to it, I think in my brain, like Harry was just so down to be explorative and like keep going. And it kept like moving different places, which is really fun to write to. And in my head, I was like, okay, well, we can do this because this isn't like, it's not going to be like the big single. So we can take a lot of like chances and like keep moving and like exploring. But now I listen to that and I'm like, I've taken that lesson of that Harry has taught me about like, let's just keep falling, whatever. Because I had the leeway of being like, okay, this isn't going to be like a big single that they push, let's keep following it. But now when I'm writing, I just follow that. Yeah. I really do. I have found that the songs that I take the most with the artists that I'm writing with, co-writing it with them, like taking the most weird turns and like key changes and following weird things, 5 years ago, I would have been like, I can't do that.
You've got number one hits
you
that
can't,
do that now.
Yeah, tons of, I mean, The Last of Man's Best Friend and Short and Sweet, like there's so many. I really recommend anybody that like plays guitar, piano or whatever, just like play through both of those albums because the key changes are crazy. And it's so much more musical than I think the common listener picks up on.
Yeah.
And 5 years ago, I would have never felt comfortable being a part of one of those, because I would have just been like, the listener, at least when I was growing, like learning pop music, it's like right to the lowest common denominator, which I have debunked like 10,000 times over in my music career, which is like the common listener is like so down and so much smarter than we give them credit for, of like exciting new twists and turns. And I feel like that was the first time in my career where I was like able to be like, oh, we can keep doing different melodies and like follow this bridge if it wants to be like 45 bars long. Like, okay, you know, it doesn't matter. From a place of that all the time, which is I'm really grateful for.
So part of what I'm hearing is it's like you're following whatever the song needs.
Yeah.
not what
and
the
like
radio
actually try like not just following it, but also like pushing the boundaries to do that. Because if it feels like something's a little bit uncomfortable or new to me, it's usually like an exciting thing for the listener. That's what I've found, at least.
We're going to hear some of those in a little bit.
Okay.
The Big Tasty is back at McDonald's, but now it's a double. It's the beefiest Big Tasty of all time ever. Oh, got a bit intense there. The new Double Big Tasty. Now at McDonald's. Available until the 4th of Jan 2026 from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
Let's listen to something really fun. Tate McRae's Greedy.
I said, are you serious? I tried, but I can't figure out. I've been next to you all night. I still don't know what you're about. You keep talking, but not much coming out your mouth. Can't you tell that I want you? I say, yeah. I would want myself. Let me please believe it. I'll put you through hell. Just know me, yeah, yeah. So sure of yourself. Baby, don't get greedy. That shit won't end well. Ooh, and well.
So fun. Okay. What a change in genre, emotion, feel. Yeah. You have got range.
Trying every day. Really trying.
Tell me about the concept for Greedy. How'd this come into the world?
This was also a good learning experience because I've had a really bad habit in my entire career that if I write a song and the artist or my publisher or somebody is like, we love it, but the chorus needs a rewrite, I'm like, nah, sorry. Like, I'm just going to write a new song. I'm not going to edit the chorus. That's crazy. But we did that song, and Tate and I both give a ton of props to Ryan Tedder on that because Tate and I have written so many songs together, and I'm notoriously bad at, like, identifying what the ones are. I'm just like, let's just write another one, let's just write another one. I'm not great at, like, being like, that's the single. Which, as a songwriter, I don't like doing that anyways because I get the ick when people are, like, songwriters or producers on the song being like, that's the single, go with that. I'm like, just let the artist decide, it's weird. But anyways, Tedder was always just like, regardless if it's a single, this song's great. We need to finish the song. I love this song. And Tate kept being like, the lyric of the chorus doesn't feel right to me. And the chorus lyric was a completely different chorus originally. We scrapped pretty much the entire thing. And I give so much props to Tate on that. And that's why she's so great at what she does. Because I feel like I'm a perfectionist, but I probably would have rolled with the OG. And she was like, it doesn't feel like the thing to me. And so we went in and we did a ton of rewrite on it, like a ton, which I never do because I hate rewriting choruses.
Was this a song where the chorus came first, the chorus that you've thrown out? Was that the first thing you wrote?
Yes. Yes. And she was telling like a really story that I resonated with. And we still kept that same story, but we wrote it from like a completely different place. And I'm not notoriously good at writing like sexy, confident songs. It's not like really my bag. But Tate just had this story, and she's obviously such a phenomenal dancer. And like, it felt like this was like the change in her career too, where she was like, wait, I think I can be really confident. She had obviously like You Broke Me First, which I had no part of. It's an amazing song. But a lot of her songs before Greedy were like very emotional, very heartbreaking, very like internal. And I feel like this was the moment where she was like, wait, I think I can be really fucking confident because like she is phenomenal. And it's like this like woman power song that it turned into. And another reason why it's so fun to write with artists, because I would have never gotten there on my own. Like that totally came from her, and I was following her lead. And I'd also never written for like movement before, which is a new thing for me. Like I'd never really thought about like writing for somebody that was like a dancer, even though I like obviously grew up on like Britney and Christina and like all these phenomenal Pussycat Dolls, like all these dance, but I never had written anything where like movement had crossed my mind. So I've learned a ton from Tate. And that song was like so fun to do together.
In elementary school, did you also have to do line dancing? That was a thing in Maine for me.
What?
Oh, no, okay.
Did you visit the Amish? Because I did that.
No.
Did you not?
We have to talk more later.
We'll talk about it later. Line dancing?
Oh, well, I was wondering, when you were growing up, you were playing like bluegrass.
Yeah.
I
wish we learned line dancing.
You loved
That's sick.
Dolly, John Prine, yeah. Like, you know, songs.
Songs.
And, you know, in bluegrass, like, we can move a little bit.
We can move like this a little bit.
Yeah.
But line dancing, sick. I wish we had that.
So, okay, so you found a new kind of confidence through a song about pure confidence. And I just want to go a little bit further to that question of the chorus coming first. Does the chorus usually come first for you? And if so, how come?
When I'm writing for myself, never. But I do that intentionally because when I'm writing just by myself at home, I'm like, I'm not writing to make it hooky. I'm not writing to like appeal to anybody but just my own, like, I'm just doing this because it feels like fulfilling in a way where I'm just like, I just need to like be alone sometimes and just like go back to basics of what I fell in love doing. So I always start from the beginning in that. But when I'm writing with an artist or for pitch, I'm still like a pop girly at heart. And I'm like, if you don't have a great chorus, like, I don't know what we're doing if we aren't writing, like if the chorus isn't like concrete, you know?
Especially,
that's how I feel.
Especially for a dance song. I mean,
especially
it's
for
get
a dance song. I definitely have friends that don't do that. But I don't know. The songs that I love, and I've said this in interviews before, where I'm like, there's so many Dolly songs, so many Tom Petty songs, where I'm like, if any lyric was pulled out, the whole song falls apart. Like, each thing is writing to build, and I just feel like having a chorus that's so bulletproof and the sentiment is so strong, there's nowhere else I would want to start in the song. I get the concept of, like, starting from the beginning and moving through it, but I just feel so much better if there's like 2 hours have gone by and I'm like, okay, we have the chorus. Like, the chorus is set. Now we just like can have fun building around it. That's how I like to go.
For a dance song, I think there's a lot of sophistication going on here. I love the phrasing of the first verse. Can we listen to that? And can you describe to me what is going on?
Okay.
You said all your serious, I try, but I can't figure out. I've been next to you all night, I still don't know what you're about. Talking, but not much coming out your mouth. Can't you tell that I want you? I say,
no pre-chorus.
No pre-chorus.
Right to the chase.
I mean, on one level, it's very simple.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of rolling eighth notes.
Mm-hmm.
Simple pentatonic melody.
Oh, no, we're getting into math.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I'm kidding.
But the phrasing, like, it keeps accenting in places you don't expect it to.
Yeah.
Like, she's hitting the phrase ends on the one of the next bar.
Yeah, it's a lot of rolling over into the next thing.
It's always rolling the next, and then it's like running on in a place where you don't expect it to run on to.
Yeah.
What is this style of writing? How do you think about this kind of phrasing?
It feels intuitive. Yeah. I think so. And I think the fun about writing with somebody like Tate, who, you know, hasn't gone to like pop music schooling, is that sometimes we'll be writing and like she'll do something that in my brain I'm like, mathematically not computing, but it just feels natural to her.
Yeah.
And that's a learning experience for me where I'm like, I actually don't remember how that verse came about, but I know many times I've been working with Tate. Actually, the end melody of this chorus, I'm pretty sure it's the very last bit of this chorus, is also something that I would have never put it on that beat. And when she was doing the take, she did it. And then Ryan and I both looked at each other like, that was weird, but I think that's good.
All right,
but it was like nothing I would have ever done.
Let's see.
I think it's the very end of the chorus.
So sure of yourself, baby, don't get greedy. That you want it.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't have pushed it like that. I wouldn't have pushed it. That's not my instinct to do that.
Huh.
But it makes it really hooky. I don't know.
Another thing that this song kind of surprised me with is, okay, we'll jump into the second verse for a second, just so it's in our ear. We're going to go into the bridge. Did you,
it's like another verse, really.
Did you write a third verse?
Yes.
You can't do that in pop music. You're not allowed, are you?
Breaking rules.
Wow. How does that feel in the room, though, where it's like, what was the last time you heard a third verse?
I know. It's not common, is it? I think that's another one of those moments where I was like, I guess it's a bit of the inverse, where I was saying earlier was like, sometimes if you don't feel like you have more lyric to say, just like don't say it. Just like go to the next section or I don't know, whatever. But that didn't feel like it needed another melody. It felt like so much of this song with the dun 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 dun, dun, like the whole little like line going through the whole song. It's so hypnotic. And I feel like usually my brain would be like maximalist and like do a different thing, do this, do that. But it felt like so much of the charm of this song from the jump was like the hypnotic vibe of it.
Right.
So it felt like the right thing to do to just like carry on that melody. Because it's just so like robotic in a hypnotic way that it feels like just the right thing to do. Instead of going to some big belty fucking thing, like the chorus is already hitting the belty notes.
Right.
You know, so like there's not really a need to like redo what we've already done. So I think that's where it came from.
It's a dance song that's supposed to hypnotize you. So like, yeah. Just keep doing the thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to another really fun song.
This is so fun.
Thanks.
I have no idea what song is coming next. I'm scared.
Let's just play it.
Kissy face, kissy face, sent to your phone, but I'm trying to kiss your lips for real. Red hearts, red hearts, that's what I'm on, yeah. Come give me something I can feel.
So if you've been living in a cave for the last couple of years, Apata by Rosé and Bruno Mars, one of the biggest songs of last year. Mm-hmm. How do you write a hook out of a spoken moment?
Love Rosé so, so, so much. That was a big room that day. That's a room that I was like, a lot of us in there that day. Yeah. It was like five of us, I think. Basically, I came into the room. Rosé was teaching this drinking game, this Korean drinking game. And
called Apata.
Yes. And this was also another really good learning experience for me, because I went through, I feel like, so much of my career being like, if the song isn't going to make me like cry and like break, fuck me up, then like we're not writing it. But Tehran,
you have a really good album, which is your debut album, which does a lot of that. And I know. Love deeply.
I'm like,
I
really, I'm learning really nothing. I still just do that. But Tehran came in and heard Rosé teaching this game. And was like, that's the song today. Sorry, that's what we're writing today. And I think Rosé and I were both like, what? Like, what do you mean? Like, it's a one-noter, like, fuck, like, what? And he was like, no, that's so hooky. We have to just make a song out of that. So a lot of that, a big lesson, I guess, is like trusting your co-writers. Because my gut was like, no. And he's just so good that I was like, okay, let's go. And she was the same way. And I mean, the chorus is kind of already written, as you can imagine. It's like right. The thing. And then my gut and Rosé's as well was like, okay, if we have like something that's like super monotone in the chorus, like of course the pre should be like as the most melodic part of the whole song, so that there's like a distinction between like when we drop into the chorus, that's very just like da 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 da. It's mm-hmm. like it feels like a release because we've just come out of something that's very dynamic. So the pre happened that way. I don't really honestly remember a lot. Like, I don't remember how we got to the verse. I almost think we wrote the pre second. I think we wrote the chorus first because I was kind of done. And we wrote the pre just to make sure that we like knew how we were setting it up. And then the verse was almost like the third part of the puzzle.
Is songwriting a puzzle for you?
Honestly, sometimes, but in a way that is really exciting, because some days it's really nice to just have it be like such an emotional, like cathartic, just like release. And then other days when you're figuring out, for me at least, I like those days just as much, where I'm like, okay, like the chorus is written. Now how do we like puzzle piece the rest of it together so that the chorus like shines as much as it possibly could? Or like when I'm writing for film and TV and I get like a very specific brief, I love that too, because it feels a bit like I'm puzzle piecing to like make sure I'm saying exactly what the producer wants, but also making it feel like honest and trying to, you know, fit all the pieces together. But
perhaps the puzzle metaphor fails in some of the other things you've shared earlier. It's almost like game design. And what's interesting is you seem to set up new rules each time you write. When you're writing for yourself, you're like, I'm not doing the chorus first.
Yeah.
When you when you learned that you could, with Harry, write these long extended outros that don't seem to fit a normal convention, you're just designing the rules of the game.
Yeah.
Each time.
Coding. Girls in STEM. I can't code at all. I think also the genius of that song, when I listen back to it now that I'm so excited by it, is Henry, who goes by Circuit, who's an amazing producer. There were three amazing producers in the room that day, and then Rosé, Tehran, and I. So maybe there's six of us in the room. I think six. The first time you hear the chorus, there's like not really any chordal information. And then the second time you hear the chorus, he's reharmed it with like, not reharmed it, he's harmed it for the first time. He's put chords under it,
which are in a minor key.
Yeah, and like wild. It just makes it feel emotional in a weird way. Mm. Like, I don't know. He's such a genius with that, because it makes you, the chorus hits different every single time. Hmm. And it like comes, I think if it just dropped down into like no chordal information every time you heard the chorus, it would not be half the song that it is. I think that like hearing it with chords underneath it the second time, then the third time is just, phenomenal production. That's a production that excites me. I'm like hard on production sometimes because I'm such like a long lived songwriter that I'm like, there's nothing to produce if we don't write the song, like whatever. But that's like songwriting to me.
How do you go? So I hope people are recognizing here the enormous range of things that we've heard so far today. How do you go about writing a like crossover K-pop pop soul song with mega producers like Circuit? Like how are you approach this new kind of session any differently than what you might have done writing Matilda?
Honestly, I think it's just that I love writing songs so much and I listen to so many different types of music, and I feel like especially that day it was really interesting because like Tehran is from the Caribbean, Rosie's obviously from Korea, I'm from the United States of America, and the other producer is from Israel. Like we're all from really different, Henry's from Canada, like there were so many different cultural backgrounds and like instincts of how you write music and how you produce in the room that day that like it's hard to not be inspired by that, and it's hard to not jump on that wave when it's happening because there was just a lot going on. And now I'm like, I look back, we just had this whole conversation, me, Rosie, and Omar, who's one of the producers on it, talking about how that's the first time in my career where I'm like, people always are talking about like music as a universal language. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I'm like, that to me, I'm like, the whole world is singing that song and a lot of the world has no idea what that chorus is saying. And everybody's still just like super hooked by it, which to me, that's the first time in my career where I'm like, oh, I've done like, been a part of like a cultural thing.
You
like
all that. Got Bruno Mars singing in Korean.
Totally. Big win. Big W. I mean, he's, I mean, also when he got added to the song, that was so exciting.
Yeah. So we've listened to four wonderful songs. That means we have one left. There's a song we must listen to, our fifth and final song of the evening, Please, 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 by Sabrina Carpenter. Let's take a listen.
All I'm asking, baby, please, 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 don't prove I'm right. Please, 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 don't bring me to tears when I just did my makeup so nice.
This song is so anti-trend. How do you think about following popular music versus working on breaking new sounds?
This is not good advice for everybody. But for me, I try really hard. Obviously, like as a person of the world, it's hard to not hear pop music when it's like out because you can just be walking on the street and it's everywhere. But I, in my spare time, try really hard not to listen to what is trending right now. Because I just find I can like fall into these pit holes of like writing what is like trying to like, I don't know. When I hear something, I'm like, ooh, it like starts to inform my brain in ways of like what's happening right now. And by the time I write a song that sounds like what's happening right now, like you're so behind the ball by the time
that song. Well, it's released 2 years later anyway.
At least. So, and Sabrina's the same way. Her and I are always like sending songs back and forth and we're always inspired by like very old things that we grew up listening to or things that we find just like digging around that are, you know, minimum like 30 to 40 years old. So I think that allows us to create from a place that's like really not confined by what is happening on pop radio right now, which I think is exciting and it makes things sound new. And same with the Harry song, I guess, like when I like broke down that thing in my brain where I was like, okay, I don't need to be like writing to an equation of like what a pop song sounds like. With Sabrina, she's like, whether it's lyrically, whether it's melodically, or whether it's like chordally, there is no blueprint of what is possible. Even genre wise with her, I mean, she can cross like country, pop, R&B, like she can span anything, which is a dream as a songwriter because there is like kind of no song we can't write, you know, like between what we love to listen to, which is across the whole, you know, smorgasbord of music, like, and then what she's capable of singing and like really selling because she's such a phenomenal artist and songwriter. It's kind of like the world is our oyster with that. And that day, and pretty much every day with her, which is why I love her so much, is that I can't think of one day where it ever was like we were writing from a place of like, okay, we've like written the deep cuts of the album and now we got to write the singles. Like, I've never written a song with her from a place like that. And I have written songs, many songs from that place where it's like, okay, I feel like with this artist or for this project, like, we've gotten like the slow songs, we've gotten the weird songs, now we got to write like the hits. And I've just never, her and I have never had that conversation ever.
There was never a moment where you were like,
no,
Espresso, that's the thing.
No, because Espresso didn't feel like that either, because there's so many wild lyrics in that song. So it felt like that was even pushing a boundary. We were like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what's going to come of that. But no, this song was just like, and also why I love Jack is because he approaches music from such like a childlike, like playful place where he's not like tethered by like what the chord structure should be or like what should happen. Like, I remember when he did that key change and we were like, yeah, cool. Like, it just was not, we weren't like, whoa. It just felt like that's like the natural progression and none of us were afraid of it. And Sabrina and I are both like capable to write over key changes. Like, it's fun. It makes, and then when it sits back again in, it's just like, it just felt really natural that day. And it just was writing fully from instinct. And I don't know, I found that that is my like most exciting, like that's one of my most exciting moments in music, because I look back on that and I'm like, oh, we were doing so many weird things, like taking so many chances. But in the room, I was just with collaborators that I love working with, that none of that felt wild to us. It felt just fun.
So here you're working with Sabrina Carpenter and Jack Antonoff, mm-hmm. and the three of you have formed a really intimate team. You've worked extensively on Short and Sweet and Man's Best Friend.
Yep.
And clearly, as I'm hearing, you're able to take risks that you maybe aren't able to if you're writing pitch songs that are going to go one song to one artist.
Yeah.
You're doing something that's a larger project. Let's listen to one of those risks, which pops up right after that chorus.
I have a fun idea, babe. Maybe just stay inside. I know you're craving some fresh air, but the ceiling fan is so nice. And we could live so happily if no one knows that you're with me. I'm just kidding. But really, really, really.
There's so much that we could talk about in this moment. The immediate thing that obviously stands out is we modulate three steps up.
Yeah.
I have a fun idea. Let's do something absolutely ridiculous.
I also love how the lyric says that. I love how the lyric is being like, I have a fun idea, and we've like just modulated a crazy
thing. Call that text painting.
Yeah. We love prosody. Yeah. I don't know. What was your question? Sorry.
What's going on in your mind? How does this happen?
I mean, the modulation was fully Jack. I don't even know if he was intentionally trying to be like, let's do something crazy. I think he was just like, this feels fun. And we didn't even second guess it and just went with it. And that's also like, I feel like that like bust down this other wall now where like in so many Sabrina songs, we've done key changes because we grew up listening to so many songs that do key changes. And then for some reason, we've gone through like the dark ages of music where like nobody was allowed to like key change anymore. It's so weird. Like, why did we all follow that rule? It's bizarre. Except for Love on Top. But mostly, I'm like, there's no key changes.
There's 14 key changes,
I mean,
think,
that's just, that's a lot. Yeah. But it's a great song.
It's the best.
But yeah, I don't know. It just felt, really, it felt instinctual. And I feel like, I know we've talked about writing is like, can be like a puzzle sometimes. But there's some songs that you just listen to and you're like, that's just instinct. Like, no.
Yeah.
There wasn't like a mathy person in the room that day being like, we could do this. It was just like, that feels like what should happen.
In avoiding trends, you might have been creating them earlier.
I often find that's what happens when you avoid them.
Yeah. So back in 2018, we're hearing more chord loops. Now we're hearing a lot of more harmonic progression, a lot more sort of curiosity. Mm. It seems like that opens up new ways of writing for you.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I mean, perhaps some of that also draws from country. You have written in country. You've written with Coe Etzel, Luke Combs, Casey Musgraves. What has country taught you?
Everything. Everything. I mean, storytelling.
You said earlier that every lyric must respond to the
next
lyric.
Yeah, I mean, if I ever feel like I'm, like, losing my love of music, I just have, like, a day of walking around whatever city I'm in that day and listening to, like, country from, like, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and I'm like, oh, I love it.
Yeah.
I love music. Like, the concepts are so good. I was, yeah, I don't know. I saved like 15 the other day just walking around New York, just like aimlessly like going into albums I've never listened to and being like, the fuck? The concepts are insane and melodically just like so interesting. Country's always what makes me like fall back in love with music, even though I grew up listening to Dolly and John Prine, but besides that, like not a ton of country. And
well, you summoned Dolly Parton. She does a feature on this song on a follow-up.
So cool.
Imagine that was quite a bit of fun. Yeah. But I want to ask you about the joy and humor that you all created. That seemed to be something that was really special about those two albums with Sabrina.
Mm-hmm.
That it brought humor into pop music in a way that I hadn't heard in a minute.
Self-awareness of a pop star is so crazy. It's so exciting to me. Also, I feel like that has been the dark ages where like every pop star just takes themselves so seriously. And I'm like, Sabrina just like has fun and she's so just like shamelessly herself. And I think that has like shepherded this new like generation of pop artists that I work with so many now that are like, let's be funny today. I'm like, that's okay. Okay. And like, it's just, I feel like it's bust down this wall where people are like, oh, we can like not have to be like this perfect specimen of like, I've never done anything wrong and I'm phenomenal and like the confident song all the time. Like obviously with Greedy once in a while, like you want a confident song. It's like, it's fun to have that, but it's also fun to have a song as a massive pop star that everybody looks up to be like, yeah, I fucked up. I did something dumb, you know, like I trusted this guy when I absolutely should have like kicked him out a million years ago. Like, I think that has created this like whole new wave of pop music. And I think a lot of it is because of Sabrina and her sense of humor and the songs that, you know, she's put out. So grateful to be a part of it because I think it's really exciting.
So you're invoking so much joy in the world by being very honest.
Yeah.
Thank you for being open and honest with us tonight and sharing your experience. It's been absolute joy.
Thank you for having me.
Support for this show comes from Odoo. Running a business is hard enough, so why make it harder with a dozen different apps that don't talk to each other? Introducing Odoo. It's the only business software you'll ever need. It's an all-in-one, fully integrated platform that makes your work easier. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, and more. And the best part? Odoo replaces multiple expensive platforms for a fraction of the cost. That's why over thousands of businesses have made the switch. So why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's O-D-O-O.com.